Welcome to Module 7. We're on page 51. The header is providing basic care. Good skills earn the respect of residents and coworkers. Objectives are to describe personal hygiene, identify three methods of bathing, explain procedures for foot and nail care, demonstrate procedures for oral hygiene, describe hair care, identify pressure points, demonstrate the use of bedpans, discuss bowel and bladder problems, explain the effects of aging and digestion. So we're going to move over to 52, reading part one, promoting personal hygiene. Cleanliness promotes good health and looking good boosts morale. So this is very important. On top of the other duties that we have to perform as nurse aides, you also want to make sure that we are making sure our patients are well-groomed, are happy with their presentation. Just kind of like you and I, you wouldn't want to go out into the world, you know, hair uncombed, wearing dirty clothing, not feeling your best. We also want to offer that same respect to our patients. So the first paragraph reads, the nurse assistant's daily routine includes many activities to keep the resident clean and comfortable. Personal hygiene, cleanliness, is important for maintaining health. Good grooming enhances self-esteem. So as you'll read on, we know that some patients are relatively independent and can do a certain amount of self-grooming by themselves. Some may just need a little bit of assistance. Some are going to be mainly dependent on you, right? So this all still goes into the care plan. Just knowing what the patient is capable and not capable of doing is going to be very important. But remember, in everything, we always want to encourage independence. So if you have a patient that maybe is not able to get up and walk, but is able to utilize their upper extremities, so their hands, maybe we're putting them in the wheelchair or transferring them to a chair in front of a mirror so that they can complete their self-grooming. So just assisting them to the degree in which they need help is very, very important. So it says follow care procedures at the facility where you work. Before providing personal care, always check each resident's care plan for any restrictions. Sometimes residents need specific care at specific time, and meeting those timelines is important. Instructions may specify a.m., midnight to noon. So this is just really quick. Military time is one of the worksheets that you have to work through and just kind of memorize. But that's very important because that's what we utilize a lot in the healthcare system is military time. It's pretty standard. So knowing that if you have a patient, you may need to do a certain grooming activity at a certain time every day. So at 8 a.m. every day, patient gets up for bath, or at 10 a.m. A patient is getting ready to get dressed so they can go out into the general room or go out to breakfast, right? So just really quick to touch on military time and time conversion. 000, right? It's basically your midnight. That's when you're starting over. And you're pretty much just going to go up an hour until 12. After 12, you're pretty much adding one until 11:59, which is 23:59, right? So up until 12 p.m., it should be really easy. So 1 a.m. is 0100, 2 a.m. is 0200. But after 1200, which is noon, then it becomes 1300, 1400, 1500. So you'd have to get used to adding the correct amount of numbers or just really memorize it, right? Going back to bathing. So it says bathing every morning and every evening. Residents are given care consistent of washing the face, back, armpits, and perineum. Always provide privacy. So in regards to bathing, you really want to follow the schedule of the facility. There's some facilities, especially in these long-term cares, where patients are being bathed on alternative days, right? So a lot of times, unless you're working maybe in an assisted living setting, patients may not be getting a bath every single day. It may be by hall or just however they structure it, but some way, somehow, there will be a schedule for the frequency in which the patient needs to be bathed, right? And we'll get into bathing and perineal care really more so in your skills portion, but this is just to touch up just some of the behind-the-scenes knowledge, right? And again, in everything, we want to provide safety, we want to provide privacy, and we want to encourage independence as much as possible. Never forget that. Over on perineal care, so this is another name for it is pericare. It's a cleansing of the genitalia and the rectum, right? So pericare is given during the daily bath and after urination or defecating. Cleansing is always done from the front to back to prevent urinary tract infection. So this is really, really important, especially for our female patients. Proper wiping for any female is going to be front to back, just because if you're going back to front, you could be bringing little particles of fecal matter up into the vagina, which is a huge, huge risk for urinary tract infection. Also why women are more prone to get urinary tract infections. Same for male, you want to work your way from the top down to the bottom, away from the urethral meatus, and making sure that you're not introducing any fecal matter or any other particle that into that area. So that's very, very important. But notice what it says here about pericare. It's a standard that you're going to complete it whenever you give the patient a bath, but also pericare is done pretty much as needed. So anytime a patient is urinating or defecating or both, you are to perform pericare. If they are capable, then you're just setting up supplies, reminding, but if it's something that they need assistance or you have a patient who is incontinent or bedridden, know that you are never just changing a patient's depends or soiled linens or soiled clothing and just putting on the next batch that is unacceptable. You are completing pericare just like you would do for yourself, right? So just some steps for perineal care. Number one, you want to make sure you gather all equipment before you begin, which usually involves washcloths, wash basin, warm water, soap, towels and gloves, bed protectors, a bath blanket if you have one. Two, always wash your hands and put on your gloves after you've gathered your supplies. Number three, you want to explain what you're doing as always and provide privacy. Four, place the bed protector under the resident's buttocks and cover the resident with a bath blanket. You may be just a towel in certain settings. You just want to have something to kind of catch any moisture beneath them and then something to kind of cover up on top of them. Five, make the washcloth into a mitt by folding it into thirds around your dominant hand. Fold the top down and tuck it under the bottom edge. Making a mitt helps prevent the dangling ends of a washcloth from dripping water onto the resident. On to page 53. Squeeze the mitt in warm, soapy water. Separate the labia when dealing with the female with one hand and cleanse the area with the mitt. Wipe from front to back, rinsing and changing location on the washcloth with each wipe. Clean the penis for a male from the tip downward with gentle circular motions. Pull back the foreskin of the uncircumcised male to clean the area. So that's going to be very important. It's two different strategies, obviously, based on the gender. And with an uncircumcised male, it's very important to pull back on that foreskin skin so that you can properly clean around the head of the penis and get any kind of dead skin that kind of sits around there. That's also a source of infection. Number seven is to use clean, warm water and a clean washcloth to rinse the area and gently pat dry with a towel. Number eight, help the resident to a side-lying position. Apply soap to a clean washcloth and wash the rectum area, again, front to back. 10, rinse and pat dry the area thoroughly. Number 11, dispose of used linen, bed protector, and supplies in designated areas, avoiding contact with yourself by your clothing. 12, position the resident comfortably and adjust bedding. 13, remove gloves and wash your hands. Report anything unusual, odors, discharges, swelling, or redness. So the last part there is a good point. Whenever you are performing any kind of skincare or pericare or giving a bath, is a great time to visualize the patient's skin. Make sure you don't see any wounds or sores, any open skin, any swelling, any redness. If you do, it's a good time to conference your nurse in or just let them know so that they can come take a look at their own time. Also, any funny smelling odors. Sometimes when yeast lives under the skin, yeast can create this very, very funky type of smell. So if you're cleaning under a patient, maybe it's a heavier patient and they kind of have flaps that you have to lift up and get under, and you're smelling something very, very funky, that may be more than just body odor. That could be a sign of some kind of fungal infection in that skin from the buildup of moisture. So that's something you want to communicate to your nurse so that that can be treated. And we'll go through the steps for the next few activities of daily living, but what's really important to know is there's a certain pattern with all of the ADLs that you'll perform. So make sure that you're always highlighting the important ones. You're always gathering your supplies first, so knowing what those supplies are. You're always performing hand hygiene and putting on gloves, always explaining your care and providing privacy, and then afterwards disposing of linens appropriately, removing gloves and washing hands, and then reporting anything that you find. This is going to be pretty much consistent in all of the care that you provide. For bed baths, and again, these will be a little easier to visualize. So this is something that you'll get a better handle on during skills. For bed baths, we have what we call full and what we call partial bed baths. For a full bed bath, it's gonna be more involved. You're gonna get pretty much all that you need, whereas a partial bed bath, you're just gonna do, just it involves a few more steps, right? Or a few less steps. So number one, you wanna assemble all supplies before you begin. The appropriate supplies will be washcloths, towels, soaps, bath blankets, again, basin with warm water, clean gown, and gloves. The main difference between this one and just performing pericare is a clean gown for the patient to change into. Two, you're gonna wash your hands, put on gloves. Then keep the resident covered as much as possible, provide privacy, close doors and windows to prevent drafts. Something I used to do before I would give a bed bath is I would adjust the temperature if I'm able to do that. I know that they're going to be somewhat exposed, so just to keep them from getting too cold, I always kind of adjust the temperature and make it a little bit warmer before I start. Offer toileting and assist as needed. Adjust bed to a comfortable working height. Remove the blankets and place a bath blanket. Remove the resident's gown and use the bath blanket to cover the resident. So again, always making sure that we have something to cover the resident. We always want to cover the body part that we are not working on. So if you're providing pericare, there's no reason for the chest or a breast area to just be exposed. You can cover that since that's the area that you're not working on. Then number 10, you want to help number 9, fill the basin 2/3 full with warm water. So again, we want to always make sure that water is warm. We don't want to shock patients and just throw cold water on them or have them bathe in a cold environment. Number 10, help the resident move toward you. Place a towel under the resident's farther side to keep the bed dry. Using a clean, mitted washcloth again, so this is going to be a similar technique to the pericare, wet with clean water only. You want to wash the eyes from the inner to the outer corner. So rinse the cloth after washing each eye. With 13, wash the resident's face, neck, and ears with soapy washcloth. Rinse and pat dry with a towel. Work from head down, washing with long circular motions. Rinse and pat dry. So really, really important key points here when giving a bed bath. We're always starting from the eye, right? So think about why we're protecting the eye, right? We don't want to start getting germs on other parts of the body and then work to the eye. We want to protect the eye. It's very vulnerable. It's open. Right, and you want to go from in out. So inner corner is going to be closest to the nose, and then out away from the nose. And then it says work from top to bottom. So you're going from neck, from face to neck to ears, and then you want to work your way down. Right, and then very important, using a circular motion to rinse and pat dry. Change the water frequently. If it starts to get too soapy, if it starts to get cold, you want to change it out for a new basin of warm water, 2/3 full. If the resident is able, offer the washcloth for cleaning the perineal area. So this is important. If you have a patient that maybe is weak, but is still, like, in the sense they're not able to get up, but still has utility of their hands, you can offer them the ability to perform their own pericare. If you have a patient who's not able to, obviously you're going to take over that function. Number 17, turn the resident to a sideline position and place a towel on the bottom sheet by the resident's back. Wash, rinse, and dry the backside. Place a towel under the legs and behind. Bend the knees to wash and dry the legs and feet. Apply deodorant, put a clean gown, make the resident comfortable, empty the basin, dispose of linens, remove gloves, wash your hands. So the next page, 54, talks about some safety guidelines for bathing. If you have a patient who is going to get up and move and do either a shower bath or a tub bath, you want to be very, very important. This is where patients are at huge risk for falling. So safety guidelines are very, very important whenever you're assisting a patient to a shower or to a tub. You want to use extreme caution to prevent slips and falls. You want to test the water temperature, then have the resident test it. Always assist residents in and out of the tub or shower. Never leave residents alone while bathing. So these are all very, 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 very important to know, right? So on your way ambulating towards the shower, I would keep my patient's shoes or non-slip footwear on until right when they get into the shower or until I'm transitioning them to step on a mat or a towel. I never want to have their feet on bare ground. That is a huge, 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 huge red flag for a possible fall. And then when the water is running, whether it's a shower, whether it's a tub, you want to make sure that you're testing the water before they are. So you're putting the back of your hand to the water to check the temperature, make sure that it's feasible, and then you let the resident themselves see if that's feasible for them. And then we're always assisting them in and out of the tub or shower. We never just get into the bathroom and then tell them to go ahead, right? We're assisting them in the shower and out. We're assisting them into the tub and out of the tub, again, because this is a high risk for falls. And then we're never leaving residents alone while bathing. So even if you have a patient who's relatively independent, can get in the shower alone, you're still going to stay around them, stay within reach, just in case anything happens, right? They could be in the shower and get weak. They could fall. They could collapse. They could slip in the shower, coming out of the shower. We always want to make sure that we are within arm's reach. For a shower bath, main thing is you're going to assemble the supplies for them. So this is going to require a towel, washcloth, soap, clean gown and clothes for them to change into. We're going to use a shower chair for safety and comfort so the resident does not have to stand for long periods of time. So most facilities should have a shower chair available. You'll have patients that are able to stand and do just fine. Just because a lot of our patients are more vulnerable and weaker, we do want to provide them a shower chair, give them the opportunity to sit while showering, just to preserve their energy, as well as also decreasing their risk for falls. Again, checking the water temperature, assist them into the shower, steady an ambulatory resident with your arm. For a resident in a wheelchair, wheels are locked during transfer to the shower chair. So this is basically saying if the patient is ambulatory, you're steadying them, kind of assisting them with your arm. But if they're a wheelchair patient, that means they're definitely using a shower chair, and you're going to do kind of a transfer assist to that shower chair, kind of like you would do to a regular chair. Encourage self-care, assist as needed with washing, rinsing, patting, drying, and dressing. For tub baths, same equipments are needed as for a shower bath. You want to fill the tub to half full. Again, test the water temperature. In the case that you're able to actually check it with a thermometer, then it should be about 105. But usually you can just use the back of your hand to kind of fill and get a range. Then you want to place a rubber mat in the tub to prevent slipping if the tub does not have safety grips or safety strips. If necessary, assist the resident into the tub, encourage self-care, and assist as needed with washing, rinsing, drying, and dressing. Dressing, we're going to encourage residents to dress and undress themselves if they're able. So you can help with the selecting appropriate clothing, but please always give your patients the option to choose what they would like to wear, as long as it's appropriate for the weather. Prepare clothing by unbuttoning, unhooking, unzipping, and place the clothing on a chair in the order it will be used. So this is important. We want to set them up to basically make this as easy as possible, right? So instead of them getting fatigued in the process of unbuttoning something or unzipping, you can have that ready to go, then lay it out, and then again, lay it out in the order in which they're going to put it on. Always provide privacy, avoid overexposure. So this, you should not ever just have a patient's room door wide open as they're changing. You want to always make sure you're maintaining their dignity and respect. Number four, gently remove clothing, starting with the upper body first. Do not force or overextend any joint. If a resident has a weak side, remove clothing from the stronger side first to put on clothing. Dress the weaker side first. So that's very, very important. Let's say you're dealing with a patient who has like a left-sided stroke, right? So their left side is going to be weaker than their right side. So that means if I'm putting a shirt on a patient whose left side is weak, I'm going to put the dress, let's say it's a shirt, I'm going to feed the shirt through the left arm and then move it over to the right, because if any extension is needed, I know that the right side can do it, whereas the left side cannot. And then in reverse, when I'm removing it, I'm going to remove it from the strong side, because again, if any stretching or pulling is required, I know that the stronger side can handle it, so that I can just slide it off of the weaker side, right? Moving on to page 55, it says gently assist the resident to dress. For slacks, gather them at the leg and guide the resident's foot through. For a shirt or a dress, gently pull the resident's hand through the sleeves. Pullovers, gently guide both arms into the sleeves and slide the garment over the resident's head. Elastic stockings, turn inside out to the heel area with the person lying down. Gently stretch stockings wrinkle-free over the foot and the heel and leg. Adjust and fasten clothing as needed. Place dirty clothing in the appropriate hamper and tidy the area. And then always ending your skills with washing your hands. For foot care, we're going to check the care plan thoroughly before providing any foot care, because foot care is not appropriate for all patients. With your diabetic patients, we want to be very, very careful. If not, completely avoid foot care. That may be something that needs to be performed by either the nurse or podiatry. So we're checking the plan of care before we assist with any foot care. Main thing is making sure that we're keeping socks on, and we want to make sure that the foot stays dry and free of any sores or blisters, right? So this can be a huge thing, especially when you're dealing with a diabetic patient. When a patient gets a sore on their foot because it's so, they may have some nerve damage, they may not be able to feel something growing there, and then that can lead to an infection, which often leads to patient getting, you know, extremities or limbs amputated because the infection has just grown and grown and grown. So it's very important when you are providing any kind of foot care or just analyzing the body that you're checking for any blisters or sores and telling the appropriate party immediately. For nail care, always check with your supervisor before providing nail care. This is the same with foot care. It is not for everyone. Only a licensed nurse is allowed to trim the nails for some residents, specifically those with diabetes. Again, the resident's nails should be short, smooth, and clean. For fingernail care, we just want to make sure that we are washing our hands before the procedure, soaking the nails in warm water, dry the hands, and then gently push the cuticle back with the towel. This isn't something that you will perform very often, but in the case that you do, you want to be familiar with the procedures and how to do so. Again, always gathering all the appropriate supplies, making sure it is allowed and appropriate for your patient, providing privacy, explaining what you're doing, washing hands, and putting on and taking off gloves before and after procedure. Again, toenail care is going to be very iffy. Mainly that should be done by the nurse. In the case that you are providing toenail care, it's on the next page. Follow the same procedures as you would do for nail care. For shaving, this is something that you will perform. So shaving is an individual choice. This is something that some patients just choose to do. Some patients do not. Many women desire to shave their legs and underarms, while many men desire to shave their beards. You want to encourage the residents to shave themselves if they are able. So equipments that are going to be necessary for this: razor, of course, towel, washcloth, gloves, shaving cream or soap, a basin with warm water. You want to wash your hands, put on gloves, explain what you're going to do, help the resident to wash with warm water, place a towel under the area being shaved. So if it's the beard, for example, you want to kind of do a bib or kind of around their neck. Hold the skin taut. So that's very important. To hold the skin taut is kind of holding it back so that it becomes flat. So kind of pulling back, creating kind of a flat surface, and shave in the direction the hair grows. Gently pat the skin dry with a towel, make the resident comfortable, clean the equipment and dispose of it properly, tie to the area, remove gloves, and wash your hands. Now over to mouth care. Poor mouth care can lead to cavities, gum disease, mouth infections, and the mouth leads way to the lungs. So oral infection can lead to a pulmonary infection, or even a cardiac infection, a cardiological infection. So it's very, very important that we're maintaining oral hygiene. It can really change the trajectory of a patient's health. For oral hygiene, it should be done at least twice a day if possible, morning and evening, and after meals if possible. Residents should be encouraged to do this for themselves, again, if possible. The following are examples of conditions that need oral care every 2 hours. If you have an unconscious patient, or you have a patient who is nothing by mouth, that means nothing is going into their mouth at all, or unconscious patient, which usually means they're probably not able to keep their mouth shut, so their mouth is probably drying out and being exposed to a lot of pathogens. Any patient using an NG tube, so a tube that goes through the nose and into the stomach to feed, which usually will be a patient who has nothing by mouth as well. Any patient that's breathing through the mouth, receiving oxygen by oxygen mask, or is feverish. These are patients we want to do consistent oral care at a 2-hour time frame because they're at more risk for drying out of the oral the mucous membranes, as well as an infection brooding in there. We're going to go over to the next page. Really quick, it just talks on the importance of safety within caring for an unconscious patient. The person's head should be elevated and turned to one side. Use lemon glycerin swabs for mouth care. Move the swabs over the tongue, along the gums, over the teeth, inside the cheeks, and the roof of the mouth. Put lubricant on the lips to prevent drying. Again, very important there, make sure you're elevating the patient, turning them to one side. We never want them to aspirate on any of the liquids that are being introduced into the mouth. For flossing, you can kind of read that through. That's not something that you're going to perform too often. Again, just know the appropriate supplies, how to start and stop. We'll go over to brushing teeth. Brushing teeth is the most important part of oral hygiene. Good care extends to the gums and the tongue. So you always want to make sure just kind of how you would perform it for yourself. Moisten the toothbrush, apply toothpaste, and hold the toothbrush at a 45-degree angle to the gums. Gently clean the entire mouth, so always get the tongue, the gums, and all the surfaces of the teeth. You want to have an emesis basin at the chin while rinsing the mouth, just so that you have something for them to spit into and you're not soiling other parts of their body. Dry the person's mouth and remove the towel. Dispose of the supplies properly. Again, remove gloves. Report any problems. If the gums were bleeding or were swollen, or the mouth was irritated, or you saw any sores while performing oral care or brushing the teeth, please, please, please notify the nurse. For denture care, so some residents are going to wear full dentures, which are false teeth, or partials, which is removable, artificial teeth attached to the permanent teeth. If a resident complains of discomfort or develops mouth sores, again, you want to notify your supervisor or your nurse. Dentures are easily damaged. After taking the dentures from the resident's mouth, place them directly into a denture cup. Remove the dentures or partials from the mouth for at least 8 hours each day. Store them in a clean labeled denture cup filled with liquid to prevent warping. So usually a good time for dentures to be set aside to be cleaned is overnight, and there will be some kind of liquid or some kind of cleaner that it can sit in, and it kind of just clean it or keep it, you know, moistened throughout the night. And then you always want to make sure that they're rinsing the dentures with cool water after eating, and to clean them thoroughly once a day. And caution, never use hot water, sharp tools, or abrasive toothpaste that can damage the dentures, and always handle dentures with care and assist residents as needed. So in the case that you are performing some kind of cleaning on the denture, you're going to need a basin, a denture brush, soft toothbrush, gloves, denture cup, denture cleaner, drinking glass, hand towels. Again, starting the skill, washing your hands, putting gloves, telling the patient what you're doing, providing privacy, assist the resident with denture removal, avoid damage to the denture, be gentle with it, place a towel under the resident's chin, brush and rinse the oral cavity, pat dry with the towel, prepare a cleaning area by placing a towel in the sink basin. This will prevent breakage if the dentures are accidentally dropped. Use a soft denture brush, clean all surfaces of the dentures, never use a sharp tool again. Gently place the dentures in the resident's mouth or store it in the denture cup with fresh, clean liquid. Again, tidy the area, remove gloves, wash your hands. Hair care. Daily hair care with brushing and combing is ideal. You want to make sure the comb and brushes are clean. Gently comb and brush tangled hair one section at a time. Place your hand on the person's head to support it so that you're not yanking their neck back and forth. Shampoo hair at least once a week. Check the resident's care plan. If permitted, shampoo during showering, following the steps. So this is going to be pretty similar to how you were to shampoo or condition your own hair. It's just that you would wash your hands, put on gloves before so. Brushing the hair gently. Again, remember, always removing the tangles, doing it section by section, stabilizing the head so that it's not moving or you're not hurting the patient. Washing the scalp. Making sure you're avoiding getting any shampoo or product in the patient's eyes or ears is very important. Make sure you use a conditioner afterwards. A wide-tooth comb, it does better with easing out tangles. You want to dry the hair immediately afterwards. Gently towel dry, then blow dry with warm water. Style as the patient desires, then tidy the area, remove gloves. Report anything that is abnormal. And those are some of the basics. We're going to go over to part two. This is tending to skin care. Aging skin needs tender care. So skin care is very, very important because we know that patients are at risk for skin breakdown, and we just want to make sure that we are not putting our patients at risk for further skin breakdown or damage or infection. So a good skin is important at any age. Some of the function that the skin includes is it's a protective organ. It provides a barrier to infection. The skin is actually one of the first defenses in the immune system because the skin is what's protecting and keeping pathogens from coming in. So whenever there's a break in the skin, you pretty much compromise the body's first stage of the immune process, right? That's why we really, really, really want to make sure that we are paying attention to skin that is not intact. Then we know it produces vitamin D, fluid balance, our body temperature, stores fats and vitamins. We feel heat, cold, and pain through the skin. And then our emotions can also have a physical, impact, right? So preventing skin problems, early intervention can prevent serious problems. The main ways that we're protecting the skin is doing frequent turns, right? So making sure that we're avoiding skin breakdown by protecting those pressure points, providing skincare through bath and perineal care, pericare, and then, putting moisturizers as appropriate, putting cushion in the appropriate parts, and then always reporting any changes in the skin as soon as we see it. Going over to the next page, this is where we talk about some of the important pressure points because this is how we prevent skin breakdown, right? So it has a little visual at the bottom of this page, very, very important. So the ears, specifically kind of behind the ears, shoulder blades, breast, elbows, the backbone, the coccyx, the buttocks itself, knees, heels, and ankles, and the toes, and the hip bone. These are going to be your pressure points. So that means when the patient has pressure on these areas for long periods of time, whether they're laying on it or something is resting on it, you are at risk of skin breakdown. That is why we do frequent repositioning and we put appropriate cushion to make sure that these areas are not breaking down. And then also moisture. So bacteria loves warm, dark, moist environments. So does fungus, right? So like I was saying earlier, if you have a patient with maybe with a little more adipose tissue and they have a bigger stomach and they have some areas that aren't exposed to light often, they can build up moisture in that area and that can lead to an infectious process. So we want to make sure that we're keeping patients dry, especially with foot care as well, keeping patients dry to make sure that we're not creating an environment perfect for some kind of infection. Avoid friction, avoid sharing, which is kind of the pulling or pressure that can happen on the skin. We want to be very, very careful because a lot of our patients, their skin's going to be a little more fragile. So again, for these pressure points, we want to make sure that we're always identifying them when we're positioning a patient so that we're not getting to ulcers, right? So this just talks quickly about different stages. You really won't have to identify or, diagnose any type of wound or sores in their different stages, just being familiar with them. The first sign of skin surface, basically like the first stage of a wound, is going to be pretty much red or pink or darkened, looking kind of bruised. It's going to basically be discolored, and it's not going to fade within 15 minutes after pressure is released, which is something we call blanching, right? It's going to be non-blanchable. That's probably your first sign. When the skin starts to change color, it's starting to look darker than usual, look bruised, it's probably heading towards a deep pressure ulcer. Second stage, you're going to have a layer of skin that's actually removed, so now the skin is not intact. It can look like a blister or abrasion or just like a little basin-like wound. At the third stage, the skin breaks down into the subcutaneous tissue, so now you may be actually able to see a little bit of fat, or it looks kind of like a crater. In the fourth stage, the sore has penetrated through muscle or bone. This is very, very terrible. We never want to get there, right? So this is where an infection is present or something is draining, right? So if we can, number one, if we can prevent this altogether, that's best. But if we can identify and start to implement, preventative measures at the first stage, the goal is that it never progresses even to the second stage, let alone the last one, right? Going over to page 61, part three. This is providing physical comfort. So we want to help residents to be as comfortable as possible. So it's important to promote rest. minimize discomfort and pain, as well as identify insomnia, right? So mainly, we want to make sure that we're creating a good routine for them to rest. That means at certain times of night, we want to make sure that we're adjusting the lights, decreasing the noise, making sure that the heat and ventilation is appropriate for the patient, making sure that our patients are not in pain or not feeling any discomfort. If they're reporting any pain or they look uncomfortable, you want to let your nurse know so that they can give any medications if possible, applying any massages if applicable. For insomnia, if you're finding that a patient is not sleeping through the night, they are up all night, the body naturally wants to rest. So if someone is not able to sleep or rest throughout the night, there might be something going on. They may be ill. There may be some emotional barriers going on. They may be in physical pain. They may be hungry. So we want to make sure that we are identifying and addressing our patient's needs so that they are able to rest. Over to page 62. So these are things that ideally, if you are in the position to do, definitely helps your patient, right? So if you're able to give a back rub, that is very helpful in promoting rest. It kind of goes through the steps there and how to appropriately go through a back rub. It's not something that will be heavily focused on because it's not something you'll always be able to do. But again, just kind of read through to see how you can be able to help your patient get more comfortable. Going over to page 63, we're going to talk through on how to use a bedpan. So bedpan is something that's very, very important. You want to make sure that you're providing privacy and minimize the resident's anxiety. Patients are often kind of uncomfortable with the procedure of having to urinate or defecate in something that's not like a normal toilet. It's something that you can imagine is uncomfortable to do, can be embarrassing, you know. So we want to make sure that we are helping our patients through this process, providing privacy, and, you know, just kind of letting them know that, you know, it's okay. It's okay that they have to utilize this measure, and you will do their best to make it as comfortable and as clean as possible. So a bedpan is something that residents who are unable to get out of bed are going to use to be able to defecate or urinate. Women use bedpans for both urination and bowel movements, whereas men only use it for bowel movements. For obvious reason, a man can utilize a urinal for whenever he needs to urinate. And a woman use bedpans for both urination and bowel movements because they are not able to obviously use a urinal. So for a fracture, you'll have something we call an orthopedic pan for the resident, and this is basically traction or cast, and for residents who have difficulties moving in bed. So it looks like the bed pan, however, it's kind of made to be a little more flat rather than the bed pan. The bed pan kind of has a little groove that should kind of fit the normal physiology of kind of the human body, whereas a fracture pan is definitely more soft, right? So going over, we want to follow the procedures for using a bedpan. We want to assemble all equipments. And the equipments are going to be gloves, hand towel, waterproof pad, disposable hand wipes, warm bedpan and cover, wash basin with warm water, soap, washcloth, and toilet tissue. Number two, wash your hands and put on gloves. Explain what you're going to do and provide privacy. Gently place a waterproof pad under the resident. Ask the resident to bend the knees with feet flat on the bed and raise the hips if they are able to. Assist if needed with your hand under the person's lower back and place the bedpan. If the resident is unable to raise the hips, roll to the sideline position. You're going to place the pan and roll them back onto the pan. If the resident is unable to raise the hips, we're rolling to the side because basically we want to make sure that we're placing it to where it's comfortable. So again, you'll get used to the normal physiology when you see a bedpan in person, but the wider portion should go at the top and the smaller portion should face towards the bottom. for the standard bedpan so that it'll just flow right in there. And the same way we get them on is how we're going to get them off, rolling them to the side and then pulling it out. Help the resident to a sitting position. So remember, it's not natural to lay down and go number one or two. So we want to make sure we're raising the head of that bed up so that that kind of just helps with gravity and them to just be in a more natural position. Place toilet paper and hand knives within reach. Place the call out. You want to step out and give them privacy. It is hard to complete those functions when someone is standing there staring at you and watching you. So make sure that you're giving them a little bit of time. Give them that call light so they can call you back whenever they're ready. Remove the gloves and raise the head of the bed. Stay nearby to check on the resident and respond to the call light quickly. When the resident has finished, put on clean gloves. Put the bed flat again, so make them flat before you go about the procedure of removing the bedpan. Assist with the wiping as needed. Remove the bedpan by turning the resident to the side while holding the pan steady. Assist with hand washing and positioning. Return to the bathroom. You want to observe the contents, so we're always looking at anything coming out of our patient. So the urine, the fecal matter, we want to look at it. Make sure it doesn't look abnormal, not very watery, not very hard, no blood in it, not dark, cloudy urine. If you see any of the above, make sure you're telling your nurse. Clean the area and dispose of equipment in designated areas. Remove gloves and wash your hands. Chart details and report any elimination problems or irregularities. And then over here to the corner, we have bedside commodes. So these are very nice because this offers, it's kind of like a portable toilet, right? So we're able to transfer patients on and off, or patients who are very weak and not able to walk all the way to the bathroom. This is very, very good for them, but it looks more natural. This feels more natural for the body. So basically the main things for this one is you're going to lock all the wheels. You're going to kind of treat it like a wheelchair. Lock all the wheels, position it appropriately, and transfer your patient on and off. Again, still leave the call light within reach so they can just give you a call whenever they're done. Same thing, give them what's needed to, you know, perform appropriate pericare, assist them with the pericare if needed. And then you're able to dispose of the bottom portion of the commode. So you take that out and pour that into the actual toilet, again, observing it first. And then clean it, of course, and put it back in. Part 5 is going to be treating bowel and bladder problems. Bladder and bowel problems need special attention. So main things when it comes to bladder problems is going to be some form of maybe infection or sudden incontinence, right? So if a patient was continent yesterday, they were able to use the bathroom on their own, and now today they're having incontinent episodes, that could be a sign of some kind of urinary problem, right? Sometimes that happens with a urinary infection. So urine should usually be kind of a pale yellow, relatively clear. If you're seeing your urine that's very, very dark, very concentrated, has a very strong smell, looks cloudy, or is just in a completely different color, or any blood in it, you want to notify your nurse immediately. That's usually going to be a sign of some kind of urinary infection or some kind of kidney problem. Bowel movements, so that's going to be the medical term for basically defecating or pooping, right? This is going to be something that happens through the anus. The frequency of the bowel movement depends on the patient or the person. So some people it's normal to go 2-3 days without having a bowel movement. Some people go every day, right? So it's different. However, stools should never be hard. It should never be painful to pass the stool. There should never be blood in the stool. And if it's exceeding more than about 4 to 5 days without a bowel movement, definitely we want to go ahead and let the nurse know, because we never want someone to experience a bowel obstruction, which is a big deal. It can actually cause the stomach to perforate, or the bowel intestines to perforate, which makes basically like explode, right? So constipation is a bowel movement that are infrequent and painful with hard feces. On to the next page. From constipation, you can go to an impaction, which is a serious form of a constipation, which means the fecal matter is just stuck and cannot move at all. This can be very, very painful and may need some, you know, greater degree of intervention, maybe a suppository or enema. So again, let your nurse know. Diarrhea is when the stool is very, very watery. This means that it's moving through the intestinal tract very, very fast, which is not a good thing, right? Because there's a lot of nutrients and vitamins that is absorbed through in the intestines. So whenever the body is losing stool very quickly in the form of diarrhea, not only are you losing a lot of fluid and water causing you to be at risk of dehydration, but you're also losing a lot of nutrients and vitamins and electrolytes, which can put the body in an imbalance, right? So again, just looking through, we've kind of talked about what these feces kind of, the feces and different urination, what they can indicate. Loose feces or very watery feces can be diarrhea. If it's ever dark or tarry, so it looks sticky or dark, that can be the cause of any internal bleeding. You want to notify your nurse of that immediately. Very, very hard stool, constipation, small and frequent feces. So let's say they haven't gone in 3 or 4 days, yet they're dropping very small little like ball-like pieces of stool or little small little kind of tarry, loose stools, and they're not putting out as much as they should for it being 3 or 4 days, that could be a sign of an impaction. For the urine, we talked about dark or cloudy. If a patient reports pain or burning when they urinate or small frequent urination, so having urgency to go, but when they go, they only go a little bit at a time, those are possible signs of UTI. For bowel and bladder training, some residents lose bowel and bladder control. That is what we call incontinence. I've already mentioned it a few times now. This can be because of age, disease, immobility, physical restraints, and confusion. Training programs basically help residents to regain control of elimination. You want to follow the instructions for residents who have training plans. Main thing is all residents need to be offered frequent toileting, right? So think of when you were potty training your child or something, right? A big thing was getting the patient on a schedule. So offering the patient, not waiting till they have an accident, but instead every 2 or 3 hours, do you need to use the bathroom, right? So keeping their bladder kind of on a schedule helps a lot with bladder training. Some residents wear special briefs for incontinence, learn to apply the briefs correctly, and proper use can cause skin problems if it's too tight. Change the briefs whenever they are soiled. Again, this is a skin integrity and an infection thing. For bladder retraining, you want to keep accurate records of fluid intake and record the time when the resident voids or wets. So we always want to make sure what's coming in is coming out, right? So that's why we're taking note of what they're drinking and then taking note of what's coming out. Going over to page 66. Bowel retraining, the goal of bowel retraining is to gain control of the bowel movement and develop a pattern of elimination. So again, it's not very easy to revert, right, to revert a bladder or bowel that, you know, is becoming weakened. We are just doing our best to assist and to make sure it doesn't further deteriorate. So that's why we're doing these training programs. And again, these are going to be further explained to you, usually by your nurse, or it's going to be explained out in the care plan. Going over to part 6, understanding digestion. Aging affects the digestive system. So to understand the elimination process, you need to know how the digestive system processes food. The digestive system is about 30 feet long. It starts from the mouth, ends at the rectum, right? So digestion begins in the mouth. When you introduce food into the mouth, you start to chew it. Immediately, you have digestive enzymes that are going to meet the food there in the mouth, and they're going to already start trying to break down the food in the mouth, right? So through the chewing down process, you're getting it to a state to where it can pass down to the next portion of the digestive system, which is going to be the esophagus. As it goes through the esophagus, it's going to then make its way to the stomach. The stomach is where you get acids that are going to further help to break down the food and, again, take certain nutrients out. Then it's going to go to it goes over to the gallbladder where bowel is released. And over to the pancreas, which further digests it and controls insulin. Then we have the small intestines and the large intestines. It starts from the small intestines, and this is mainly when the food and water is absorbed into the bloodstream. So again, when you have someone with loose stools, that means it worked its way through the small intestines very, very quickly, right? In the large intestines, this is where it reabsorbs the water and moves the feces along, and then it's going to end at the rectum and then come out through the anus, right? So that's the general portion. So main thing is the body is going to take whole food through mastication, which is basically chewing, chew the food, add all these enzymes that are coming from the salivary glands, start to break down the food, go through the esophagus, right? So there's a little portion called the epiglottis, which separates what's going to the lungs and what's going to the mouth. Because if you think about it, both air and food are going through the mouth, right? But they're going to go to two different portions. So aspiration happens whenever something is wrong with that epiglottis, and instead of food going to the stomach, it goes to the lungs, right? So the epiglottis, if it's intact, after the food processes in the mouth, it should work its way through the esophagus, get to the stomach. Again, more enzymes are at play. Acid is at play to further break it down. Gallbladder releases its appropriate enzymes to further break down the food. Again, this is how insulin and sugar is regulated in the body. Pancreas is a big portion of that. Then it needs to move from the small to the large intestine. Then it makes its way out of the body. So again, this will tell you why, how constipation works, how diarrhea works, how impaction works. It means at some part of this process, usually at the intestinal region, something has slowed down or something is moving too quickly, right? Flatulence is basically just gas moving through, which is a medical term for excess gas, which is necessary. Gas is being produced, especially in the stomach, when acid is introduced. The urinary system plays an important role in removing waste from the bloodstream. So the urinary system involves the kidneys, the ureters, the bladder, and the urethra, right? So the processing of what's going to come out as urination is going to start in the kidneys. This is where the kidneys are filtering water and blood and different proteins and enzymes. Then from the kidneys, they go to the ureters, and they pass their way down to the bladder. The bladder holds the urine until a certain level. And then it now signifies the urethra to open up and release. Hopefully, if you're in conscious control of that, then it's notifying you at the brain level, letting you know it's time to go use the bathroom. If the patient is incontinent, it may just do it on their own. You want to be alert to UTIs. It's very, very important. It can be very detrimental, especially to the older patient. It can lead to changes in mental status and confusion. So we really, really, really want to be alert and aware of patients who are at risk of developing a urinary tract infection. Lastly, the summary says, before giving care, always tell the resident what you're going to do. Be familiar with each resident's care plan and be alert to any restrictions. Offer choices whenever possible and encourage residents to provide self-care to the extent they are able. Residents have the right to participate in decisions about their care. Keep residents as comfortable as possible and ensure their safety at all times. Promote good health and self-esteem by keeping residents clean and well-groomed. Provide gentle skin care and reposition residents often. Encourage good oral hygiene. Offer frequent toileting and be readily available to assist as needed. Avoid embarrassing or offending anyone at any time. Again, we're going to go over to page 68. You have your 8 review questions. Make sure that you're really able to describe foot care, safety measures, identify all of the pressure points, 5 of them at least. How does aging affect the digestive system? Describe bowel and bladder training programs. What is impaction and, what does that look like? And explain the use of bedpans, urinals, fracture pans, and bedside commodes. And that concludes chapter 7. I know that was a long one.